Today, the federal government has crossed the much-hyped and dreaded deadline for the fiscal reductions known as the sequester. So what's the fallout for us here in Iowa? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Here in Iowa, the cuts are expected to be felt most in three areas: education, also Iowa National Guard operations, and at workforce development. We'll talk with Colonel Greg Hapgood of the Iowa National Guard, Tom Ahart of the Des Moines Public Schools, and our own political scientist of Iowa State University, Stefan Schmidt. Then in the second half hour, should pulse ox testing be mandatory for newborns? We'll talk about that. But first, we start with what the sequester cuts might mean for Iowa and for you. After this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We heard in our news that speaking after the meeting with congressional leaders, President Barack Obama said earlier today, budget cuts slated to go into effect today are the choice of Republicans who stonewalled any compromise to avert them. President Obama said the pain will be real for Americans as the sequestration gradually kicks in. And he added that economic data in the coming months will reflect the consequences of what he called dumb, arbitrary cutbacks. In a brief statement to reporters after his meeting with the president, House Speaker John Boehner reiterated that Republicans will continue to oppose Democratic proposals to raise new revenues to offset the cuts. We have a new estimate from the Congressional Budget Office saying that the spending reductions would amount to $42 billion in this current fiscal year. Well, here in Iowa, the cuts are expected to be felt most in three areas, according to state officials: in education, in the Iowa's National Guard's operations, and at workforce development. That's the agency that helps unemployed Iowans find work. A sample of what's at risk. To be more specific, hundreds of teaching jobs, perhaps thousands of children drop from early childhood education, elimination of work-study jobs that support thousands of low-income college students getting a degree, loss of child care for thousands of disadvantaged kids, furloughs for thousands of civilian Defense Department employees. Well, as the sequester day deadline has arrived, we want to hear from you this first half hour. If a budget cut is affecting you, likely to affect you, your family, your business, let's hear from you. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us to begin with is Colonel Greg Hapgood, Director of Public Affairs for the Iowa National Guard. Welcome back to our program, Colonel Hapgood. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure.
Governor Branstad warned earlier this week the impact of the federal sequestration in Iowa likely be felt first and hardest by the National Guard, also Iowa Workforce Development. White House estimates are for approximately 2,000, according to my estimates, 2,000 civilian Department of Defense employees being furloughed here in Iowa, reducing gross pay by more than $7 million. Does that tally with what you have, and can you give us more details?
Well, specifically regarding a reduction in personnel salaries, we have approximately 1,100 men and women who fall under the category of federal technicians, which is the category affected potentially by sequestration. Of those 1,100 folks, it's our understanding from Department of Defense directives that they will be required in the event of sequestration, beginning in late April through the end of the fiscal year, which is late September, to take 1 day per week of unpaid furlough through the end of the year, which is 22 days of unpaid time per individual.
So the first effects actually starting in April or before that?
Well, with respect to furloughs, those aren't scheduled to happen until late April, but there are other things that the Iowa National Guard will feel with regard to whether it's purchasing equipment or temporary assignments or maintenance on equipment or structures, utility bills. There's a number of different areas that we are reducing our expenditures there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So your game plan if the sequester continues in its present form?
Well, we've been talking about this for a number of months as an organization, and particularly over the last 6 weeks, we've really hammered out some areas that we are going to work to make an impact on to position us better. like I said previously, particularly things like building maintenance, which we can defer unless there are things that are really emergency, things that could affect health or safety. Those are things we would take care of right away. But other things we will defer. Maintenance on certain pieces of equipment we can defer. Purchases of new equipment, we can defer those as well and just continue to use the old equipment that we have and take good care of it and keep it serviceable. Mm-hmm. So those are the areas besides the personnel furloughs is where we'll see the most movement.
Talk a little bit more about the challenges this poses to the Iowa National Guard in terms of day-to-day operations and specifically any impact on readiness.
Well, readiness drives everything we do, whether it's to be here, ready in the state of Iowa to respond to some kind of emergency situation or to go to combat. We have to be ready every day of every year. And with those things in mind, we have really looked at the kinds of areas that we need to make any reductions. And those areas can't affect our bottom line of readiness. So, you know, we've really looked to cut any fat whatsoever that we have. And whether it's operations on Camp Dodge or any of our other locations in 40-some communities around the state, we've looked at those reductions that we can execute, but they can be reversed if necessary, and that's really what we focused on.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that all the cuts that you have planned, should this sequestration continue, will not impact readiness at all?
We are working very diligently to make sure that we maintain the same level of readiness, yet be able to make cuts in certain areas, and we believe we can do so.
Okay. Are there effects that you see as still unknown in your area?
I think there's a lot of second and third order effects that we just simply can't guess at this point on what they will mean to the organization. Mm-hmm. It's been a number of years since we've had any kind of draconian cuts or furloughs like this. And so, you know, you've lost that body of knowledge of how to best weather those kinds of cuts because that generation is gone that really went through them the last time. So as an organization, we've really had to, you know, go back to the basics and say, what are the areas that we really need to focus on to make sure we're as strong as possible and cut in other areas? So those are the things we've concentrated on.
Is there, in a certain way, perhaps a small upside here in that you're being forced to look again at streamlining, which you said hasn't happened for quite a while?
You know, certainly we're going back to an era that really is pre-9/11, when, you know, there were few deployments and they were generally peacekeeping or non-combat. And, you know, for the last roughly 12 years, it's been lights out with respect to combat deployments, readiness to go to combat. So we've really had to go back to the basics. And, you know, that's the silver lining in this particular case is that you have to learn how to really do as much as you can with less. Over the last 12 years, we've been incredibly spoiled in the Iowa National Guard. We've gotten just about everything we've wanted to keep our men and women ready to go to combat. As that combat mission in Afghanistan draws down, we still have to maintain some semblance of readiness, but we really have to figure out, you know how to do the best that we can with what's going to be available for resources.
Colonel Greg Hapgood, Director of Public Affairs for the Iowa National Guard. Please stay on the line if you can, Colonel Hapgood. I want to add to our conversation. We said education, an area that would be hit hardest by the federal sequestration cuts going into effect sometime today. At least today is the deadline. Phil Rader is joining us. Phil is Director of for Community Relations for the Des Moines Public Schools. You're on the phone line, Phil. Welcome to our program.
Hello, Ben. Good being with you.
Give us an overview of what you expect there in the Des Moines area to be the impact of the federal budget cuts.
Well, for Des Moines Public Schools, and of course we're the largest school district in Iowa with just a little over 32,000 students, the direct impact for us would be $2 million, which in our case equates to about 26 to 27 full-time employees, if you look at it that way. And, of course, the bulk of our budget, like most businesses and public entities and school districts, the bulk of our budget, of course, goes towards personnel costs. Now, the good news for us is that direct impact really doesn't take effect until July 1 when the new fiscal year begins. And, of course, we tend to be optimistic and hopeful in the education business, and I guess we're of the mindset that if a group of kindergartners can work together in a classroom, then hopefully the adults in Washington, D.C. can maybe do likewise and get things worked out before we get to July 1. The one thing, though, that's still a big question mark for us, and I think for all school districts across the state and probably across the country, is the impact of any immediate indirect cuts that might happen. For example, we may face an indirect effect due to cuts to the USDA, which, of course, supports our school breakfast and lunch programs. We don't know exactly what the impact might be on federal funds that go out to school districts through the State Department of Education. So there's some indirect funding that we receive that is still a question mark for us, and will probably take a little bit of time before people appreciate what that may or may not mean.
Mm-hmm. Two follow-up questions. Firstly,
sure.
on the direct impact, you said 27 full-time employees in that $2 million figure. So that means when you start the new fiscal year, at what time should this continue? Would you have to select those employees and give notice?
Well, if it comes to that, it would be right away. And whether or not that might take the form of cuts or furloughs or some combination, our finance staff is still looking at those options. But again, if there's a good thing with sequestration is for that direct impact, at least there's several weeks, in fact, 4 months before that would hit us immediately.
Mm-hmm. For Colonel Hapgood of the National Guard, it was a matter of readiness to be a focus of attention. Of course, for you in public education, it's the quality of the education for our children here in Iowa. Can you take these cuts, $2 million in the Des Moines public schools, and still deliver the same quality education, or will that be affected?
Well, there will be effect. I don't think we can kid ourselves into thinking that if there are teachers and associates and staff taken out of schools, that it's not going to have an effect. And, of course, because of the economy over the last several years, we've had multiple cuts of state funding over those past several years. And so if it comes to this come July 1st, that will just add on to what we've already faced with an education, which has been several years of cuts on and off. And so it certainly would have an impact. Again, we're hopeful that everyone in Washington will get something worked out that's in everyone's interest before we get to July 1. But if that does not happen, it's certainly going to hit school districts large and small across the state and across the country.
Mm-hmm. Have you done any planning, streamlining, should these cuts go on, that would, cut some of the fat without getting into the meat, the muscle?
Well, we've done, because we've been faced with different cuts at the state level over the years, a lot of that's been done. One thing that our district's focused on a great deal in recent years to save funds is in the area of energy efficiency. In fact, we've gone from having about half of our schools air-conditioned in Des Moines to now having just about 100%. And yet at the same time, because of the work we've done, we've actually managed to reduce our utility bill by about $1 million a year as a result of that work. So there's been, you know, things like that we've done district-wide to save what amounts to real money here and there, partly because it's the right thing to do, but partly because of other budget constraints, we've been forced to do that. So there have been things like that that have been in place, because, let's face it, we've all had some practice at having to cut spending here in recent years.
Phil Rader, the Director of Community Relations and Legislative Liaison at Des Moines Public Schools, on the line with us. We want to add to our conversation this first half hour as we talk about sequestration budget cuts, how they will impact us here in Iowa. Let's get a political perspective from Stefan Schmidt, a university professor of political science at Iowa State University. It's not a Wednesday, but we need you, Stefan. Thanks for being available for us.
It's my pleasure, and this is certainly you know, a huge topic, and there's a lot of politics to it in addition to, let's call it, economics and math.
Mm-hmm. So the day has arrived. Your thoughts on how it got here when we thought it would never arrive, it would never come to this?
Well, frankly, I think I am one of those contrarians that I believe that both the Democrats and Republicans have wanted to cut budgets, but under normal circumstances, there are programs and departments that are untouchable, and that would be political suicide if you cut them in a normal budget process. And the military is one of those. I mean, untouchable. And so they set out this essentially ticking time bomb or automatic system whereby they're not cutting anybody's budget. Obama isn't cutting anybody's budget. The Republicans in Congress are not cutting anyone's budget. It is the sequestration that is cutting the budgets. And that's, in a way, a way to avoid actually getting in there and taking on interests that are very powerful and that are very popular. And so I think my own view is that both the Democrats and Republicans, to some extent at least, may just let this thing glide and say, you know, we don't want to cut any of those programs. We don't want to cut the National Guard, you know.
Yeah, however, we have seen both parties trying to blame the other. The Republicans saying, not just saying sequestration, but they're saying the president's sequestration or Obama's sequestration. We heard the president earlier this morning promising that should this continue, as long as it continues, he would connect every bit of bad economic news in the coming weeks, the months, to the Republicans' intransigence here.
That's absolutely right. And you know, the public is puzzled. There was a very interesting article. The polls show that most Americans don't understand where this came from. They don't understand how it works. They don't understand who's to blame. And as long as the Democrats blame the Republicans and the Republicans blame the Democrats, essentially, it's an even score. Nobody in particular gets blamed more than anyone else, and there are fewer political consequences if everybody is to blame or nobody is to blame. And frankly, 10% across the board, is a heavy burden for some programs. But you also have to remember that there isn't a single government program that doesn't think that it's currently underfunded and that therefore it already has too little money and needs more resources, not fewer, at the same time as our national budget is ballooning and the national debt is growing, and everybody agrees that at some point we're going to have to wrestle that under control. And so this could very well be a moment when people who are opposed to big government, such as Governor Scott of Florida, realize that, wow, big government is really, really important, and he has been kvetching about how the National Guard of Florida isn't going to be ready for the forest fires that are coming and then the hurricanes that are coming. And so it's very interesting because, in a way, it's a civic lesson, which is government is in a lot more places and a lot more present than most people realize on a day-to-day basis. And this thing is going to make that more real. And at the end of that, in June, it may actually lead to a saner and sounder negotiation between the White House and Congress on how to do more strategic budget cuts and also how to enhance more revenue, which everybody thinks we also need to do.
Okay, Stefan Schmidt, let's check in with Josh. We've been asking for listeners to call in with how these sequester budget cuts will affect you or your family. Josh, you're traveling on I-80. Are you going to be affected? Are you being affected?
I am going to be affected, and a lot of my friends are going to be affected, too. I go to school in Kansas City, and if they cut work-study, a lot of work-study students, that's money that these students rely on to, pay for their books and pay for their other supplies. But also the universities are going to be affected because they're not going to be able to provide these services, which they rely on the work-study money students to provide for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So a student in that case would look for other sources of income?
To be honest, it's really hard to find other income because there are very few jobs on campus that are not work study jobs.
Okay, Josh, traveling on I-80, thank you for that. Stefan Schmidt, if I can come back to you and ask, when we look forward, what are the possible outcomes here? Is this a matter of weeks, days, weeks, months? What's going to happen?
Yes.
Yes, all of the above.
That's right. It's going to be a matter of months, because even if they can stop the bleeding from the sequestration, we all know that there are a series of other huge hurdles coming up. There is a budget discussion. There is
raising the debt limit, right?
Another debt ceiling coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not the only sort of frightening scare that we're going to suffer. And I think it is going to drag out. And the reason is, frankly, that both parties have a completely different philosophy and a different economic theory about the role of government and how that should function. And it's grown wider apart. It used to be that Democrats and Republicans sort of generally could agree and they could tweak it here and there. But, you know, the Ron Paul people, the Rand Paul people now, fiscal conservatives, are saying, well, you know, 10% across the board, that's fine. Every program and department probably can use a 10% cut, and none of us like it or want it because we're getting all these things that are funded by taxpayer money. But it isn't, the world isn't going to end, and the readiness of the National Guard may very well be reduced somewhat. But on the other hand, it could also probably use improving even more, because none of us are at a level of performance that's optimal. We could all use more revenue in order to improve whatever it is that we do, including work-study programs and other things. And so there is a real philosophical difference, and one side sees it as, you know, we've already overspent, and these programs all have got too much revenue, and we have too many things the federal government is doing. The other side, Obama and the Democrats, are saying, no, you know, there are many things we still have to fix in this country, and it takes taxpayer money and government spending to do it. And so that's a very daunting hurdle to overcome.
Mm-hmm. In the remaining minute we have, Stefan, tell us, I guess the phrase the president used that has been popularized is careening from one crisis to the next. It sounds like you do not see an end to that in Washington, and that's what we'll be talking about on Politics Days to come for weeks and months.
I agree. I mean, I think that has been the pattern here. We are careening from one thing to the next, and there isn't going to be an election until 2014, and that election may or may not resolve the huge conflict between the Congress and the White House. Obama is in there, you know, for 4 years, and so it is going to be an ad hoc kind of decision making in Washington. And I have a feeling you can live with that. The Italians have lived with that for the last 60 years. And so you can certainly live with a kind of lurching from one thing to the next, and you become used to it, and that becomes the new normal.
I don't know how appetizing that is, politics of the Italians. I would take the culinary side of that, Stefan, but I'm not sure the politics are going to be appealing to most people.
Let's agree on that. Let's take the culinary side.
Okay. Stefan Schmidt, thank you very much. Iowa State University professor of political science. Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you.
Also, thanks Phil Rader, Director of Community Relations and Legislative Liaison at the Des Moines Public Schools. If you're still there, Phil, thank you for joining us this half hour.
I am, Ben. Thank you very much.
And also thanks to Colonel Greg Hapgood of the National Guard. Thanks for your perspective, Colonel.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ben.
When we come back in just a few minutes, we'll talk with a mother whose tragic firsthand experience led her to push for a certain type of mandatory screening for newborns. It's a bill in the legislature. Perhaps you've heard of pulse ox testing. Should it be mandatory for newborns? We'll talk about that when we come up right after this break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Good to have you with us on this edition of River to River over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Not much time remaining to keep a piece of legislation alive that would require all Iowa hospitals to screen for congenital heart defects. It's the number one birth defect in Iowa. For the remainder of the hour, we'd like to discuss the legislation, the bill, and talk about what this screening for newborns involves. It's called pulse oximetry. Screening, or I guess the shorter, easier way to say that is pulse ox, as it is commonly called. And joining us first of all from our Des Moines studio, Mandy Faulkner is with us, a mother of children who have congenital heart defects. Mandy Faulkner, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
And Mandy, tell me where you're from in Iowa, where you live.
I live in Humiston, Iowa.
Okay. Now, just tell us your story and how you discovered the birth defects in your children.
Well, it wasn't until after we had lost our son, Travis, which has been 3 years ago. He was born with three different congenital heart defects. And after we lost him, it was a very short time later that my daughter collapsed at our local public school. And that's how we discovered that she also had a heart defect.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry for your loss of Travis. Tell me a little bit more about his birth. I understand he's one of a twin.
Right. Yep. In August of 2009, my husband and I was blessed with twin boys after having four girls. Mm-hmm. And my pregnancy was perfectly normal. Nothing out of the ordinary when he was born. They did the pulse ox testing on his brother, but not on him. And so we had noticed that his hands and feet were starting to look a little blue. And we called for our nurse. And the nurse came in and basically whisked Travis away. And then the doctor came in and told us that that there was a problem and that Travis had three different, congenital heart defects.
And he died at what age?
He was barely 6 weeks old when we lost him.
Tell us more about Kylie's story, because her heart defect surfaced much later, years later.
Yeah. Yep. When Kylie was born, we were told that she just had a heart murmur, but not to worry about it, that children grow out of them, usually between the ages of 5 and 7. Kylie was 6 years old when she had collapsed at gym class, and it was she was diagnosed then with supraventricular tachycardia, and then she also has what is called a bicuspid aortic valve, and that's instead of having three leaflets, you have only two. One is conjoined to the other leaflet.
Mm-hmm. And thankfully, she was life-flighted to Des Moines, I believe.
Yeah, and they, she's had kind of quite a road with her medical problems as well, but she remains positive through all, thank goodness. So,
right. How are your other children? Have they had heart problems as well?
My other son, Travis's twin, Tommy, has been diagnosed with Marfan's, and his older sister, Abby, also has Marfan syndrome. That is a connective tissue disorder, but it affects the heart as well. And so they both have dilated aortas from it.
Mm-hmm. What is your understanding of the degree to which pulse ox testing was done on your children, especially Travis and Kylie?
It was not done on either one of them.
On any of your children?
It was done on Trig, who was born afterwards, and it was done on Tommy. They did it on Tommy because Tommy, when he was first born, was taken to the NICU because he was having a hard time breathing. He had swallowed fluid, and so they did do it on Tommy, but not on Travis, because Travis looked, beautiful, healthy,
right,
pretty in pink. So they did it on one, but not the other. And then with our youngest one, Trig, they did it on him, but it was kind of like, I guess, at the hospital, we were known as, oh, there's the Faulkner family, the one that lost the baby type of reputation. So, but Trig is very heart healthy. So.
In just a moment, we'll hear from a pediatric cardiologist. But first of all, your message, what do you want to say in regards to this legislation before we hear about what this procedure involves?
It is so cheap, and it's very non-invasive, and it can save any child's life, a baby's life out there. I wonder if it had been done on Travis, if they would have caught his heart problem sooner. I wonder the same thing with Kylie, too. I mean, with it not being done on either one. I do know that right now that hospitals are voluntarily able to do it, but with my statistics, they only did it 2 out of 7 times. So,
and do you know the reasoning that they used for doing it or not in each of the cases?
Just the
appearance of the baby.
I think that's all. I think really that's what it is. Is if they're showing signs of distress, they do it. If they don't, then I don't think they do.
Joining us by phone with me and Mandy Faulkner, Dr. Benjamin Reinking is with us, pediatric cardiologist at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. Dr. Reinking, welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Mandy Faulkner's story here, the unfortunate loss of of Travis, a baby. Might mandatory pulse ox testing have made a difference for Travis in this case?
You know, it's possible that pulse ox testing could have made a difference in Travis's case, and I'm very sorry that the family went through what they have. So the pulse ox testing is designed to look for low oxygen levels that would not be apparent just by looking at a baby. And not all heart problems present that way. So the pulse ox testing will look for about 7 specific heart problems that aren't easily detected on exam, but can be detected with the pulse ox screening.
Mm-hmm. And how good is it at detecting those 7 congenital heart defects?
So it varies on how the test is administered, but when the test is administered according to some of the guidelines that have been published, it has a greater than 95% chance of picking up up those problems.
Earlier today, I had the chance to take a test, which I was curious about, but really it's less invasive than having your blood pressure checked. It was the electronic device put on my finger was similar to a sort of a fat a clothespin type of thing, electronic, and within seconds gave me the oxygen content of my blood along with my pulse. Is it the same way for a baby with such tiny fingers?
So in a baby, the probe is a little bit different. So the probes are actually look like small pieces of tape, and they're applied either to the palm. They can be wrapped around a finger or wrapped around the wrist. And so there's one probe placed on the right hand, and then another probe is placed on the foot.
Mm-hmm. So what is the cost of this? The time taken in the delivery room and the cost?
So the cost of the probes is probably less than $10. I've been told around $4 is the cost of just the material. In terms of time for the screen is done in 3 steps, and so the first step is done, and if the infant passes the screen, then that's all that has to be done. There's also a cutoff for an immediate fail, but then there are some indeterminate screens, and so then the screen has to be repeated, and that's repeated over the course of 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so at most it would take 5 minutes, probably, at the beginning of each hour if it was administered 3 times.
Dr. Ryan King, as a pediatric cardiologist, do you see that it makes sense to make this mandatory?
I think it really does. Iowa already has a newborn screening program, and so there is already testing that's done on every newborn in the state. And the items performed on the testing currently are actually less common than congenital heart disease. And so adding this to the newborn screen makes a lot of sense to me.
Also joining us now, Stacy Freeland, a Government Relations Director at the American Heart Association in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Stacy.
Hi.
You've been listening to this conversation, and the American Heart Association is behind this bill here in Iowa. In what way?
We are completely supportive of this bill because, if we can save a baby's life by doing the screening, then that's why we're doing this.
Mm-hmm. What? Give us an idea of the scope that this mandatory test would have in Iowa. Would you care to put an assessment of the number of children who could be saved, the number of defects that could be identified early on?
It's hard to quantify, but this is the number one birth defect, and it's the number one killer of babies. So it's hard to say, but just one life is important to us, and it's important to all of the moms out there like Mandy. So that's why we are so passionate about really trying to pass some legislation this year.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about the landscape in terms of hospitals across Iowa, if you know this. Do hospitals now, since it isn't mandatory statewide, is there a hospital policy that decides it, hospital-wide policy, or is it individual to the doctor?
From what I understand, it varies by hospital. The health department has been kind of assessing where the hospitals are at on this, and the majority of hospitals in Iowa are doing this test, but our concern is that not every hospital is doing it, and we want to make sure that it's one of the standard things that's performed before a baby leaves because, as Dr. Rankin could attest to, a baby could code when they get home, and
that's really, it's critical to get that screening before they go home and they could code and, mm-hmm. and possibly lose their life.
Ben Reinking, do you perhaps know the more of the answer to that question, how it is decided in hospitals across Iowa?
So I can provide a little background, I think. So there was sort of a national recommendation that the pulse oximetry be included in the universal screening program for newborns, and that recommendation came out in September of 2011. And so the Department of Public Health, has been really proactive in at least spreading that information to the local hospitals. And I don't want to speak for the Department of Public Health, but I know that they sent out literature and things to the different birthing centers in the states. And I think one of the barriers is that not everyone has experience dealing with newborns that have problems, and so not every nursery has used a pulse oximetry oximeter in the past. And so there has to be some education about using the pulse oximeter. And then the other barrier has been if the screen has failed, then that infant either needs an echocardiogram or they need to be transferred to a facility where the echocardiogram has been done. And so establishing those relationships is still a work in process. But I know that the number of facilities that have been doing the screen has been gradually increasing since the September of 2011.
Mm-hmm. Would there be any legal consequences of a heart defect being detected later but not identified by the pulse ox test? Does it complicate matters, I guess I'm saying, from a legal point of view for a medical doctor?
Yeah, I think anytime, I'm sure it does. So anytime you miss something, even if it's something that's not apparent on exam, that's a situation that you'd like to avoid. And so I think the pulse ox screening does kind of add another extra level of safety there for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Also joining us now, State Senator Janet Peterson, a Democrat from District 18. Senator Peterson, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Your position on this proposed legislation is we should do it. It should pass. Correct? Tell me a little more about why you think so.
Well, absolutely do I think that we should pass this legislation. I don't think any baby should leave the hospital without the test. And certainly if we don't mandate it, then we don't know for sure that every baby in the state has been reached. The other important aspect of the legislation is including the test in the newborn screening, because that's how we'll know that birthing hospitals get the training that's needed to do the screening correctly, that they're using the right equipment, and also that they're reporting back to the state on what their findings are. One of the best things about our newborn screening program is that it helps us see trends with babies born in our state and hopefully maybe unlock some of the mysteries behind things such as congenital heart defects, stillbirth, and other things that may happen in a baby's birth. And so it would be nice for our state to be able to collect that data as well as the data we collect on other screens we do on babies.
Senator Peterson, are there any monies attached in this bill? For instance, you mentioned the training. We've talked about the training, extra training needed at some hospitals. Would the legislature be coming up with some of that?
Well, the Department of Public Health attended the subcommittee yesterday where we talked about this legislation, and I only was there for a portion of the meeting, but I believe they said it would cost roughly $100,000 to get the software needed to incorporate that into the pool of data that they're using for the existing newborn screening.
And that would cover all Iowa hospitals?
If I understood them correctly, that would cover the cost of connecting the screening results to the Department of Public Health. And so that's something that we'll have to work out through the legislation as it progresses through the process. If it requires funding, we'll have to find the funding to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The likelihood of the bill becoming law, what's your feeling at this point that it will be able to go over the hurdles it needs to?
Well, I'm hopeful. Yesterday, we had a great showing from families that have been personally affected by the issue. But as with any issue at the State House, legislators need to hear from constituents, and they need to know if people want this to happen. And so I think this is one of those bills that needs Iowans to come and get on their computer and send an email out and let their legislator know how they feel about it. The more we hear from people, the better the chances will be of it passing.
Okay. Also joining us by phone now, Stan Burbrick, I believe. Is that correct, your name, Stan?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Stan, welcome to our program. I understand you're program manager for newborn screening at the State Hygienic Lab at the University of Iowa. Welcome to our program. You had a related newborn testing aspect to throw into our conversation, didn't you?
Yeah, just the idea that with newborn screening, the opportunity to for many of the disorders that we screen for in the newborn screening program are disorders that aren't apparent at birth. They appear healthy, and so you don't suspect anything. And so the opportunity to actually perform these tests before damage begins to occur is a fantastic opportunity to provide benefit to these children. And this year is actually the 50th anniversary of newborn screening in the nation, and so there's going to be some celebration around that this year across the country. And in Iowa, we are going to be adding an additional disorder to our newborn screening panel, the severe combined immunodeficiency disorder. I think it's known by many as a bubble boy disease that actually allows an opportunity to identify these children before a serious infection can occur and potentially take their life. And this condition that's known as SCID is the first disorder actually that we've been screening for that actually holds the opportunity for an actual cure to it with a bone marrow transplant. So we're moving to get that in place and begin screening yet this year.
I'm interested, Stan Burbrick, the number of screenings that are done on newborns these days. I have a feeling it's been added to in recent years. Can you say approximately how many screenings happen within a baby's first hours of life?
Well, we get a specimen, so just a couple spots of blood on a filter paper card. And those couple drops of blood on the filter paper card were actually able to perform tests that were looking for more than 30 disorders that otherwise undetected and untreated would cause severe damage to the newborn.
Interesting. Stacy Freiland, Government Relations Director at the American Heart Association, you have been involved probably with other states besides Iowa. I wonder, in terms of this test and other newborn tests, how does Iowa stack up with a pulse ox test? Are we behind by not having mandatory testing?
Well, we have about 9 states that have already passed legislation on this, and we probably have about 26 states that are pursuing legislation in the nation right now. So we have a lot of states that are working on this, but some are farther down the road. Some have developed work groups and are going to be signing I know South Dakota it's on the governor's desk right now awaiting signature. Mm-hmm. So we do, we are a little bit behind in that, every day that we aren't doing this screening is another baby's life at risk. So
when we look at states across the country and this pulse ox testing, the mandatory provision here, what opposition has come up in other states?
The opposition that we have here in our state and also in Wisconsin is the Hospital Association is opposed. I can't speak for them, but what they said at the subcommittee yesterday is they just are opposed to this type of a mandate. But it's interesting because other states, their hospital association is as neutral or actually working with the Heart Association and other groups that are working on this.
Not much time left, but Dr. Ben Reinking, why would idea of why the hospital association might be against this?
I'm not certain of why they would be against it. I know there sometimes is an issue with reimbursement for doing the screen. The second might be that some of the rural hospitals that don't have immediate access to a center that can either perform an echocardiogram or they have to transport a baby, that's an addition to their their work that they haven't had to deal with in the past, so it'll take some time to develop those relationships. So
okay.
those are the only two things I can think of.
Just a few seconds left. Senator Peterson, on that note, do you have anything to add? Potential opposition you'll have to overcome in the legislature.
You know, I think the Hospital Association was the only organization that spoke out against the legislation. But certainly, I think most hospitals on an individual basis wouldn't want their patients to think that they're opposed to doing the test. So I'm hopeful that they'll change their tune as the legislation progresses.
Okay, if it doesn't pass, you'll bring it up again?
Oh, sure, I will. I don't think we should, you know, I'm hopeful we get it done this year. But if not, you know, I'm a fighter, so I'll keep going.
State Senator Janet Peterson, thank you for joining us. Also, thanks to Dr. Ben Reinking at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital, Stacey Freiland, the American Heart Association, and Mandy Faulkner, thank you very much for sharing with us a difficult episode for your children. And again, sorry for the loss of your child, but thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from Rick Fredrickson, I believe, today. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Also, welcome to our latest team member, Ben Stanton. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.